Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring inspiring stories from great Americans who are making a difference. Your host is West Point grad, former Army Ranger, and founder of Authentically American, Dean Wegner.
Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast. It's my tremendous honor to introduce today's special guest, my friend, Lieutenant General retired Keith Huber. General Huber is a great American with an incredible military resume that spans nearly four decades and circles the globe. But you would never know it by talking to him. General Huber is a humble and true servant leader who seeks to put others first in absolutely everything he does. Keith is continuing his service now to our military veterans by leading the Middle Tennessee State University, Charlie and Hazel Daniels Veterans Service Center, the largest in the country. I know you will be inspired by his story. I certainly am. Well, Keith, welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, and thank you. As busy as you are, I know it's often tough to decide where you're going to invest your time, and I appreciate you choosing to invest it with me this morning.
Well, when I had the privilege to first meet you and learn about the work that you're doing, I commented to you what an appropriate fit of not only your service to our nation in uniform, but the terminology, the name of your company resonates so well with the military, because what is more authentically American than the privilege to serve and defend our nation in the cloth of the United States Armed Forces?
There's no doubt about it, and I, like you, had the honor of wearing the Army uniform and serving our country. And it's just interesting, Keith, as you know, we've grown our friendship and I get to know you and hear about your career, not only 38 years serving our country, but what you've been doing most recently at MTSU. I'm like, how do we get it all in here in our usual time block? But so often I think, you know, what shapes people's future career and the life directions they take is, you know, their early upbringing. So take me back to when you were young, and what was your growing up years like?
Well, my grandfather grew up on a small farm in Illinois, and I tell people he left that farm in Illinois twice in his life. Wow. Once was to go to World War I, wow, where he was a doughboy in the Battle of the Ardennes. And then the second time was, I was reminded of it yesterday, the 1st of July, as I recalled, 48 years ago, I entered West Point on the 1st of July, 1971, and my wow grandfather, I like to say now he accompanied me, but he may have escorted me under guard to ensure that I wouldn't change my mind. So I grew up in upstate New York, learning to hate snow. But I spent my summers in Illinois learning the rigor of being a farmer in the Midwest. And you talk about God's people and hard work and honor, just tremendous. So my father grew up in that same farming community and left that same farm to go to World War II, to fly P-38 fighters in the Pacific for the Army Air Corps. So my grandfather, my father served our nation in uniform, as was the custom for that generation. I mean, you and I have talked about my regret with the fact of our American public now, less than one half of 1% have ever worn a uniform. So who do they think their veterans are? Where do they gather that information? Is it from the paper? Is it from movies? And all of those overly exaggerated references.
Right.
And then how they can't comprehend the sacrifice of our heroes, our military family members. So I had a background of military service with the role model of my grandfather and my father, though neither of them were career military. In fact, it's interesting. My father used the first GI Bill, which at the time was called the Serviceman's Readjustment Act. So you just think about that title of what are we readjusting from World War II. But my father went to the University of Illinois and got his master's degree in crop dusting. So he took the skills that the Army Air Corps had provided him and he applied them to the farming that he had grown up in. And that's what we want veterans to do. We want veterans to take the skills and the discipline and the emphasis on team building and team leading and honor and candor and accountability and responsibility. And we want those veterans, as they take off their military uniforms and don a different attire for this next chapter of their lives, we want them to be able to apply what they learned in the military to reintegrate our communities and our business world.
You know, Keith, I'd never heard that story from you about your father and the crop dusting. And I mean, we'll talk more about what you're doing so amazingly well at MTSU, but it starts to all make sense in that transition and what you're passionate about right now. And I mean, what I'm hearing, both your grandfather and your father, you know, one of our American heroes that served our country. And I'm just curious, because West Point was a path you said neither one of them were career, but was that kind of a path that you knew you were going down, West Point, or how did that come about?
I had no clue. I graduated from a high school in New York in a town called Ossining, which was three blocks away from Sing Sing Federal Penitentiary. I mean, that was my motivation. My mother would always chide me and go, "I'm not sure you're studying hard enough, son. I'll take you down the street to Sing Sing." And so I think we visited West Point once or twice. But unlike some of my classmates who were destined, who came from generations of West Pointers, and that focus on a career military opportunity, I applied to West Point. I already had been accepted at Cornell and University of Maine. When I was privileged to be selected to go to West Point, I went there for one simple reason, and that's because of the look of pride I saw in my parents' eyes.
Oh, wow.
And I go, not sure what this is, but it can't be a bad thing to do something to make my parents proud of me. So I went into West Point with very little understanding of what I was going to encounter. It was a long 4 years for me. It was a huge maturation process for me. I will be forever grateful for it. But I never imagined that I would then have the privilege to serve 38 years of my life on active duty, nor be selected to be one of the Army's senior military leaders.
Wow. And I'm just, you know, having flashbacks myself, Keith, because today there's activity on Facebook because it's our day anniversary, and thinking with my parents there, and we also had, you know, very little idea, but just seeing, you know, the joy and pride that they had, and then as they're getting ready to say goodbye, they probably did the same thing. Okay, you've got 2 minutes to say goodbye, and then the tears just start flowing. Yeah, it just brings back memories as you're sharing your story a few years prior. So tell me about West Point. I mean, that's 4 years in your journey. You said it wasn't easy, but what was some of the things that you took away from that experience?
Well, let me start by things that I wish I had done differently. I did not recognize the requirement nor the benefit nor the appropriateness of necessarily interacting with my classmates. I was focused on trying to improve myself and survive the experience and the academics. So, and I'm naturally an introvert. When you hear me speak in front of groups of individuals, however small or large, and you've been there tormented by me talking before, but you know that I mentally prepare myself extensively, but I refuse to read a script or to read notes, because I've always been convinced, regardless of the quality of how you deliver the words, if you're reading it, somebody's going to go, gee, I wonder who wrote that for you.
Right.
I wonder if that's really what you believe, and especially the more senior you become. So I'm an introvert, and it takes considerable energy for me to open my mouth and speak to groups. I wish now, as I have few friends, but in my mind they're people that I would be willing to give my life for.
Oh yeah.
But I was not a very gregarious social critter, and and I don't think I am. I don't think I've improved, but at least part of the improvement is the recognition of things that you wish you had done better, because I mean, none of us do it on our own. And so, I mean, when I tell people that I entered West Point the 1st of July, 71, with a draft number of 3, I often wondered if I did it over, if I should have gone to Vietnam and hopefully been a non-commissioned officer and clearly understood the repercussions of what officers' good ideas meant to the people who actually did it, and how many rocks you were putting in somebody's rucksack. Now, you know, I had the privilege with my special operations opportunities to then work in small groups and small teams where rank really didn't have any impact. Everyone did what needed to be done all the time, and you recognized the burden of your decisions with those that had to implement them. You know, when I went to West Point, we went to class on Saturday. On Sunday, they put us in formation and marched us to chapel. Right. I mean, so there was not very much discretionary time, and maybe that was good. So you didn't have the opportunity to be mischievous, but it was a tremendous experience for me academically, emotionally, physically, one that I think set the foundation for a toughness that I didn't have going into the academy.
Wow.
When I graduated and went to my first infantry platoon, I remember, because during my time at West Point, we didn't have the interaction with the non-commissioned officers that they do now, and I think that's a huge improvement.
Oh, yeah.
But in my mind, as I entered my first rifle platoon, I was the only airborne ranger in the company, and there were only 2 airborne rangers in this light infantry battalion, me and the battalion commander, who had been a chemistry professor of mine at West Point. But I entered a situation that I talked to young officers about now. I entered a situation where I was the only non-combat veteran. Everybody had tours in Vietnam. And so youngsters going into the Army now are going to face themselves where the likelihood that everybody's been to Iraq and Afghanistan is very significant. So I was the only West Pointer, I was the only airborne ranger, but I didn't have, in their mind, the competency or the right to be that leader. So West Point, in my mind, didn't prepare me for that scenario, but it gave me enough common sense and self-confidence to go, okay, I can figure this out. And it taught me the importance of building a team and not being concerned with my youth or my lack of qualifications in any specific arena, but to show people that I was there to serve and I was there to learn.
I want to touch, Keith, on the leadership a little bit later, but one thing that you shared that I would not have guessed, because you had said, I think it was suffered through your speaking, that would not have been the adjective I'd have chosen. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed what you had to share, but it sounds like from very early in your career, you know, to this day, it's still something that does not come naturally to you speaking in public. And the reason why I'm bringing this up, because if people listed their biggest fears, at the top of most people's list would be speaking in public. So, you know, share some tips on how you've overcome this, because again, I thoroughly enjoyed what you shared last week versus your adjective of suffering.
I think you've got to view it as a responsibility of leadership, that you've got to be visible. I mean, just like now. I'm not here because I'm bored. I'm not here because you're paying me. Mm-hmm. I'm here because I believe in you.
Thank you.
Because I believe in your organization and what it represents. And I'm here with appreciation for this opportunity to talk about our veterans and to share an awareness of veterans and their families and how, if they need assistance in the difficulty of transition, that I'm here to serve them. But it's a responsibility to show people what you think is important,
right,
and to inspire people and to share with people your thought process. And the more senior you become, it used to amaze me that senior people didn't want to talk aloud, didn't want to describe their thought process or the reason why. Mm-hmm. And I go, why don't you describe this? And they go, well, gee, I'm afraid people will figure out I'm not very smart. And my comment would be, gee, you don't need to open your mouth for people to do that. I mean, you've got to connect, in my opinion, at the human dimension level, that we're all focused on the team and the success of the team. And this isn't about an individual or your ego or your arrogance. This is about describing the task, condition, standards, and then your thought process, so that people can then go, okay, we got it, we know you're in charge, we know you're the boss, but did you look at the problem set in this fashion? And when people do that, they humble you and they say to you without saying it, gee, I respect you and I trust you. I trust you that you will allow me to make this comment about your logic without you then brutally criticizing or humiliating me, because I know what you're concerned about is what's best for the team. So when people offer suggestions because you've gone, okay, here's what we're going to do, here's how I came to this arrival, here's why we're going to do it this way, and somebody goes, okay, we can do it that way, but what about this way? And you go, wow, I never would have looked at it that way. That's a better idea. Let's do it that way. And so public speaking, especially in an international environment, especially in different languages, you have got to have command of the knowledge of what your task and role is. And while most people will be less honest with you, I mean, I would hope that you can be candid with someone without being disrespectful. Mm-hmm. But most people, if they're honest and they see you reading a speech, they'll go, hey, great speech. Who wrote it? And particularly the more senior you become, it amused me that the more senior you become, you got all these dozens and hundreds of people who think that their task is to do your thinking for you or to give you words on what to say. And you go, why would I want to take my instincts and my experience and put them aside? I got it. I developed my subordinates. I've already got somebody ready to step in for me. So I'd have speech writers give me speeches, and then we'd sit down and I'd go, okay, here's how I critique, here's my comments for your speech, thank you very much, couple data points there that I hadn't thought about, I'll incorporate it, but I'm not going to stand up in front of this group of people and read this speech. And you shouldn't take it as an offense to you or a criticism, because what you're doing is important, but it's not my mannerism. I mean, I remember a book that Jim Mattis gave me when we were both one stars together in 99, and we'd gone through Capstone, and it was The Legend of Bagger Vance. And he said, you know, maintain your original swing. I mean, you've got to figure out who you are as a human being and not change who you are as a human being, not sacrifice your character or the quality that our parents put in our fingerprints, but to be an honorable, honest, transparent leader and recognize your responsibilities. And part of that responsibility is to be able to analyze your audience, understand what is relevant to them, and then speak truth to them. And that's the benefit. I mean, as you become my age now, at the tender age of 66, the disadvantage is you may ramble, you may lose where you are, but you never have to worry about consistency, because when you tell the truth as you know it, it'll always come out the same.
Well, Keith, I love your response, because part of me was wondering, is there a secret formula, a secret to what you've done? And really what I heard are twofold. One, you see it as a privilege and a responsibility when you have an opportunity, whether it's a group of five or 500 or 5,000. And then the secret ingredient is that it's all about preparation. It's not
exactly.
About
exactly. I'll call it amusing. It may be disturbing and frustrating, but how many people will, out of curiosity of what it's like to listen to a three-star general, but they'll go, you know, just grab one of the general's normal speeches, and how many senior people are lazy, that they don't want to change? They go, hey, I'm senior. You should just be appreciative of listening to my words. And let me grab that speech that I gave this time last year for this event, and let me read the speech to you, which is only surpassed by, let me put 100 slides on the wall and let me read the slide deck to you. But they don't do any preparation. They don't do any assessment. They leave the impression that they really aren't concerned with saying something relevant. My concern to every group that they're kind enough to ask me to talk is, I don't want to waste their time. I want to be worthy of their attention. I want to say something that is relevant to who they are. And then when I'm done, you know, people will go, gee, can we get a copy of the general speech? And the answer is no, because I couldn't tell you what I said. I could tell you the themes that I mentally prepared myself for, But I can't tell you what I said. I read the audience, and I get enthused and excited, and hopefully nobody gives me the body language, they're falling asleep, and I go, okay, I guess I'm saying something that they think is worthy of their attention.
So another key point is part of the preparation. I mean, you could give the same speech that would take a completely different shape based on the audience, so it's doing the homework and the due diligence and preparation, say, okay, who am I speaking to? What do they want to hear? So the themes, back to your point about the swings not changing with Bagger Vance, but your delivery may change.
Yes. So. And everybody does stuff different. And I would never suggest that you should do anything like I do. People would accuse you of poor judgment. But that's why, you know, the whole concept of a best practice, I find, and when I talk to businesses about hiring our veterans, and I talk to leader development, and they talk about best practices, I find that whole concept to be not only inaccurate, but obnoxiously arrogant. Because to me, when you say, here's a best practice, you're going, okay, if you want to be good, drink this elixir, take this pill, do this action, and you will be successful. And it avoids the reality check of what is the context. Everybody's fear when they talk to the media is looking for this soundbite that they can then take your words and manipulate them into whatever comment they want to make. Well, to me, a best practice doesn't involve, doesn't describe the circumstances. It doesn't define the question you're trying to answer, the problem you're trying to solve. So I'm not trying to be glib with Webster, but I believe in a promising practice which goes, here's the circumstance, here's the conditions, here's the situation we were in, here's what we tried, here's what the result was, we viewed it as successful or unsuccessful, and we offer it for your consideration, for your modification, because we know that you will be in a slightly different or dramatically different circumstance.
So, Keith, let me transition to where you've spent the majority of your career. And when people say career, you know, 20 years earns you a retirement, earns you a career in the military, and you served our country for 38 years. So first and foremost, thank you. It's incredible, and thank you for your service. But I don't even know where to begin looking back and hearing your career. So, you know, I want to talk about what you're doing now, but what's one highlight, one story that people would say, okay, here gives me an idea of what Keith's career was like?
Sometimes people ask me, what tour was your best? What location? And I know that's what they're asking. They're going, gee, you've traveled the world. What was your fondest memory? What was your favorite location? And I'm sure that the response I give is not one that they had anticipated. I suspect I should be accustomed to saying things that people aren't necessarily prepared for. But, you know, I'm very proud of the fact that I had the privilege to serve as an infantryman and a Green Beret. To me, the tours that I felt I was best prepared for and where I felt I made the largest contribution were the worst tours. And those were tours in conflict, in peacekeeping, in combat. So those were my tours as a young Green Beret captain in Nicaragua and El Salvador. My tour in Haiti with the United Nations, my tour as commander of U.S. forces in Kosovo, my tour with Desert Storm, my tour of 2 years at the end of what turned out to be the end of my time, my 2 years in Afghanistan, and the privilege to spend 14 years at the rank of a general officer and then be allowed to retire as a three-star general in the Army. But I felt humbly that I could best serve my men and women in the darkest of circumstances and when they were there sacrificing and in a combat or a hostile environment.
I love to hear that because arguably, whether it's peacekeeping or combat, these incredibly challenging and stressful situations, that's where, you know, leadership is going to be most important. And I know one thing that's most important to you is not only family, but, you know, soldiers and those that you've served, and you take it as a great honor and distinction and that responsibility. So it's not surprising at all to hear that's where you had the greatest impact.
Where I attempted to have the greatest impact, and I'm so fortunate because I have people who humble me every day by contacting me, and saying, gee, we served together in this location, or I was your guidon bearer when you commanded a company in the 101st and you convinced me to go to OCS. I was a mechanic in the motor pool when you commanded a battalion in the 101st, and now I'm a command sergeant major. I was a young second lieutenant, and now I'm a two-star general. And, you know, people that go out of their way to say thank you when it's really, I'm the one that should be saying thank you for allowing me to develop as a soldier and a human being. And that's, I mean, you know what it's like. And you know that that's the biggest challenge to men and women in transition, whether it's 4 years or 40 years, when you take off that uniform and you immediately lose your sense of purpose. And how, when I'm sitting here in Afghanistan and I get the phone call from my West Point classmate, Lloyd Austin, who was the vice chief staff of the Army at the time, and he goes, hey, Keith, I guess I'd been in Afghanistan for probably 20, 21 months, and he mm-hmm. called and goes, hey, God bless you. You're doing a great job. Thank you for your sacrifice. You know, you're coming up on your 2 years there, and timing's not right. You're not going to be a four-star. We need you to retire. Mm-hmm. And my response was, absolutely. Thank you for the privilege to, at that time, I mean, of my West Point class, there were three of us who remained. Lloyd Austin, our only four-star, and then Bob Caslin was in Iraq, and I was in Afghanistan. And that privilege to serve, though I saw people who felt, in my opinion, erroneously, that they were due, or that they should get another job or another star. So it's a humbling experience to serve, but you shouldn't feel that the nation owes you anything, okay. But you lose that ability to feel that you're worthy. And you clearly, what I miss every day is the men and women that I served. I miss every day not being around people that I can unconditionally trust, and that we're bound together by a commonality of mission and service and sacrifice. And so that's the challenge to any transition, is how do you feel that you're worthy, that you're doing something important for the nation, not for yourself or your own self-promotion? And where is that group of people that you know that they trust you and that you respect and that you serve?
So speaking of serving, Keith, I mean, you'd mentioned Webster and the dictionary and that, and I feel like when you look up servant leadership in the dictionary, you know, your name should be listed as a reference, because leadership personally is something that I strive to improve each and every day with my team and getting better. And it's like, the harder I try, I find like, you know, am I getting any better? Because it's such a challenge. And you've been a role model for me, just, you know, as I get to know you and your servant leadership philosophy. So, you know, tell me a little bit more about that.
I talked to a group of senior industry people the other day. They asked me to come and spend a couple hours with 100 plus of their VPs and senior leaders, and we talked about trust. Mm-hmm. And so I think, and it's funny. It's not. It's amusing to me, but I have some people who go, General, what do you know about leadership? You're a general. You don't need to lead anybody. You got tens of thousands of men and women that you don't need to lead them. You just order them to do stuff. You just order them. What are you going to teach me about leadership? And I go, wow, from my foxhole, you don't understand what I consider to be the essence of leadership, which is so clearly explained and comprehended in the stark reality and simplicity of combat, where people are actually living and dying, and you're making decisions which ultimately will lead to life and death circumstances. And so to me, you can't order people to follow you. That people allow you the privilege to be their leader, that people willingly follow you at times to their death, not based upon your gender or your physical size or your age or your religion, or even in the military, your duty position or your rank. People follow you willingly out of a sense of mutual respect and trust that you got to earn every day. So to me, as we all evolve, and I'm not a guy that believes that you're a born leader. I think leadership is a skill, is an attitude, is a human mannerism that I know I've never had an original thought in my life. I know that I've interacted with people and I've selected techniques and things that they did that I said, wow, I'm fired up, I'm inspired, this is great. Or unfortunately, as is the reality, sometimes it's like, boy, I just went through the most abusive experience of my life and I promise I'll never do that to somebody else. But it's all about trust. And so people want people to trust them. But if you honestly reflect and you go, you know, somebody just said this to me, you know, on the surface, it sounds like a really good idea, but something in the back of my head is going, nah, there's got to be more to it. And why you think that? It's because you don't trust that individual. So to me, the first step in earning someone's trust, for you to earn my trust, you got to convince me that you care more about me than yourself.
Yeah.
And so that's a daily struggle. And then we talked about, I know everybody's busy, but don't give me the impression that you think your time's more valuable than mine. And how do we show people what's important? It's not through technology. It's not through podcasts. It's not through YouTube. It's by physically there.
Presence.
That you say, you're important enough to me that I'm going to be here.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to learn from you. And the recognition that the older you become, the more senior you become, hopefully you don't fall into that trap that you actually think you know something. But you should recognize how little you know and try to set the conditions so that your diverse team can teach you and can find the best solution for the team. And success is a team effort. It's got nothing to do with individual stardom.
Yeah. Keith, I'm hearing a theme because you talked about, you know, speaking in public, talking about leadership, and what I'm hearing is you would not say you're a naturally gifted speech maker, nor are you a naturally gifted leader, but what I heard you say is you take it as an incredible privilege and responsibility in both instances, and with both of them, it's about preparation. And we talked already about speech being, but what I'm hearing is leadership is that you read as much as you could, you observed as much as you could, and you look for role models and mentors and coaches, and it's really just starts with that trust and a heart.
Absolutely. That's the way I believe, and it's interesting because sometimes people will accuse me, is probably the wrong word. People will think that I'm speaking off the cuff because I'm not reading it.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go, gee, you know, the general just sort of decided to wing it. And people who know me will go, oh, no. He prepared for this 30-minute discussion. He prepared 3 hours to do this. And And so I'll write down, once I do my assessment of the audience and what is important to them and how I can contribute to their day and how I can be worthy of their time, I'm convinced most people will walk away with two or three main points. And so I'll write those down on a piece of paper, and then I'll do some bullet comments of how I want to reinforce that, and then I'll talk to myself and go for a run or walk around the house, and I'll talk out loud and say, boy, that doesn't sound like what I'm trying to communicate. Sometimes I'll tape it and play it back and go, who's that idiot on the tape recorder? Did I really say that?
That recorder doesn't lie.
And so I'll prepare myself that way. And it probably, even when I'm familiar with the topic, because a lot of times when people ask me to speak, I'll go, okay, what's important to you? You select the topic. And not that I'm trying to say, hey, I can talk about the world, I'm so knowledgeable. To me, success is not only that I had your attention, but I contributed to being worthy of your time. And so I go through a great deal of preparation. I'm convinced most people don't.
Agreed.
And I don't want to say they don't prepare because they're lazy, and we can all improve on our time management. But by golly, you really do yourself a disservice, because people will know whether you're prepared or not. I mean, it's not something you can hide behind. People will go, wow, you know, that was horrible. That was a waste of my time. You know, that was too, I heard him give that speech 2 years ago. I mean, well, one of the interesting comments I get from people who don't know me but who have endured me several times is they'll go, I mean, it happened Thursday night. Mm-hmm. Said, we heard you speak last year, and it was sort of the same topic, but you know, you didn't approach it the same way.
knowing your audience.
And I go, right. You know, I don't have a tape recorder. I'm not lip syncing this. You know, I don't have a canned speech because I feel that people will not view you as genuine. And people don't expect you. I don't expect our leaders to be perfect. I expect them to be accountable. I expect them to be responsible. I expect them to be humble. I expect them to correct mistakes they make. I expect them to admit mistakes they make. But I don't expect them to be perfect.
Right.
I want them to be human. I want to be able to recognize that they may be older and have more experiences, but there's somebody's son or daughter. There's somebody, brother or sister. They're a mother or a father. They go through the same challenges of life, and they have people who love them.
Well, Keith, last topic I want to hit.
You're cutting me off. Here we go.
Like I said, we could go on all day. But here's the last topic, and it's what you're doing today. Because after 38 years, you could have said, you know what? I'm going to lay on the beach. I'm going to relax. I've worked hard. You could have perfected your golf game. You could have worked in the defense industry. I mean, there's a long list of things that you could have done. And you chose something different. So tell me more about your decision, education, MTSU, and to continue to serve veterans.
It didn't start out with a deliberate decision on my part. I never would have imagined. I mean, I sort of reflected back on West Point, of how I got to West Point, and never with the intent nor the ability to go, gee, I'm going to stay 38 years. I just stayed in the Army, and as long as they asked me to do something, I went and did it to the best of my limited ability. So when I came out of 2 years in Afghanistan and then retired, as requested. I had four major surgeries, so I spent my first year home trying to reintegrate. And as you know, I'm blessed. My son's 36. I got three grandsons, 10, 6, and almost 4. And then I have the blessing of a 12-year-old daughter at home. But mm-hmm. but when I left for Afghanistan, she was 5, and I came home when she was 7. Mm. So as I was working through reintegrating with my family and then had surgeries, which for a year kept me housebound and in the majority of the case, bedbound. And I felt that I was a burden on my family. So not only had I missed 2 years of their life, but now my reintroduction was being a burden. So the second year of my retirement, I called the ROTC departments across the volunteer state of Tennessee, and I said, hey, you know, I got a couple days in the Army. I'll come and speak to your ROTC commissioning award ceremonies. I'll talk to your academic leadership. Whatever fits into what you're doing, I'll do it all pro bono. And I was humbled that the majority of the public and private institutions invited me. It was during one of those events at Middle Tennessee State University when President McPhee said, Gee, I'd like you to come back, and I'd like you to talk to all my deans and my vice presidents, and I'd like you to talk to them for a couple hours about making hard decisions. And I did that, and then he said, gee, I'd like you to come and work for me. And because I want to take our veteran population to the next level. I said no. And like most instances, when you get that answer that you don't expect or you don't like, you know, I could read it in his eyes that he's going, God, this guy's not too bright. You know, he doesn't recognize the tremendous opportunity I just gave him. But our response is always, well, let me speak slower and louder, and General, I want to hire you. And I said no, and finally we got around to the important question, and that was why. Yeah. And I said, because you don't know what you want me to do, and without you knowing what you want me to do, I can't do two things. I can't do an assessment as to whether or not I think I have the skill set to do it properly, and more importantly to me, I can't determine if it's something that I want to do. I mean, as you mentioned, a lot of my contemporaries are very successful news commentaries, very successful in the defense industry. Those are things that I knew I didn't want to do for me, but I didn't know what I wanted to do or if I'd ever be able to make a contribution. So I told President McPhee I'd do a 60-day assessment of who his veterans were and what they expected, and I'd go around and look at other veteran centers, and then I'd come back with a recommendation, and we'd have a further discussion. So the first place I went was Arizona State University to look at their Pat Tillman Center. I went to San Diego State. I went to places that said they had veteran centers, and I learned from them. And then I came back, and at the time we had 1,038 student veterans at Middle Tennessee State University out of a student population then of almost 22,000. And I talked to them, and then I went back to President McPhee and gave him some recommendations. And the American Council on Education has great ideas, and in fact they got 8 things that they say, if you want to care for student veterans on your academic institution, here's 8 things that we think is our requirements for a successful student veteran program. And of course, the first one would not be strange to us, and that is you got to have the senior leadership of the academic institution mm-hmm. support it. So based upon my briefing and suggestions to President McPhee, he initially provided 2,600 square feet and $329,000 and allowed me to design and build and equip and staff what was called initially the Veterans and Military Family Center, and then what is now been renamed to the Charlie and Hazel Daniels Veterans and Military Family Center. And it's grown to 3,200 square feet, totally dedicated to veterans and their families in transition. And so some of the uniqueness of what we have is we're the physically largest space dedicated to veterans in transition. We're the only place in the nation that has two fully funded VA employees in the center every day, and one of them's a mental health counselor. We have a greater collaboration with the VA than any place I'm aware of. And we focus on providing answers to issues for transition. And there's no requirement that you're an MTSU student. So we literally assist veterans and their family members every day worldwide without a requirement that you go to MTSU. And we use the Daniels Center to do that. And we've got an employer search agent. We're connected to businesses. We get veterans hired. We get their family members hired. If they want to understand their VA benefits, we describe them. If they need access to their VA benefits, we help them. If they have issues with their VA benefits, we help them. If they want to understand their education benefits, we help them with the paperwork. We give them options. We don't go, gee, we're only going to do this if you're going to enroll at MTSU. I think our responsibility is to provide options to veterans and their families when they need them. I mean, this is my biggest complaint about the transition program that exists at any military installation, is it's a great program, it's a mandatory program, but my comment is people are not always emotionally receptive to the information flow at the time you give them. They're sitting there and they're going, gee, I wonder if the movers are coming today. I wonder where we're going to live. I wonder if I'm going to be able to get a mortgage loan. I wonder where my kids are going to go to school. And so to me, to serve veterans in transition, you need to have the willingness and the capability to answer whatever question they have, wherever they end up, whenever they want the information. It gets to this trust. Where do we go to ask a question from somebody we can trust to give us an unbiased, accurate option and not try to sell us something or manipulate our decision making? That's the trust that we seek. And how can we talk to a fellow veteran? So I'm very honored to have the community involvement and the business leaders and incredible collaboration with the VA in service to our veterans in transition. And this is one of the things that I appreciate this strategic opportunity to communicate with people. And my message is, if you're a veteran, if your parents are veteran, if you bounce into a veteran, if you need to understand your VA benefits, how to get access to them, how to resolve issues with the VA, look up the Charlie and Hazel Daniels Veterans and Military Family Center. Go on the MTSU website. Contact me, contact us. We will fix it. We will help you. If you're looking for a job, we'll help you with the resume. We connect you with employers. We're here to serve, and we're not going to charge you anything for it. We want to provide transition assistance when and where and how people need it.
Keith, thank you, because I had not heard the story on how it came to be. But what I have seen and had the privilege to tour the facility with you, and as I talked to some of the veterans there, what I heard loud and clear was the trust and the caring, because it'd be easy to say, okay, here's the phone number to call, here's the website to call. But what I saw, role modeled by you, is people say, okay, you need help? Let me sit next to you, and we'll do it together. And that's when, you know, people care, that's when they know you want to make a difference, and that's when it's genuine. Back to our discussion on leadership. And now, as we're wrapping up here, I mean, we talk about themes and trends, and it's not just been 38 years, Keith, of service. It's continued your time at MTSU, and I don't know how many more years you're spending or planning to spend at MTSU, but I know one thing that's going to be for sure. It's going to be focused on serving others. So I just wanted to say thank you, Keith.
No, thank you for this opportunity.
And do have a gift for you, two of them. You know, being a fellow West Point alum, there's something we enjoy celebrating that first week in December. And we've done it now 3 years in a row, but beat Navy. So I'm hoping this, Keith, will be your new favorite. Go Army, beat Navy. You know, T-shirt for you.
Well, thank you very much, sir.
So that is one. And you are dressed quite nice today. And I believe I'd given you one of the red and blue ones, being a great American patriot. But when you're wearing a darker suit, these are... Carolina cotton, knit in Carolina, so great American patriot socks for you to wear as you're given your next speech.
Authentically American. Thank you, sir.
Keith, thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Authentically American podcast. You can follow Authentically American on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and find all our episodes at authenticallyamerican.us/podcast. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thank you for listening.